And good morning. It is Monday, November 16th, and we are live in the broadcast studios of 88.5 KRFY for a special Monday morning interview. I'm Susie Prez, and here with me today are Gary Payton and Jean Girth. Good morning, Gary and Jean.
Good morning.
Good morning, Susie.
It's nice to have you here. And Gary, you're heading to Paris in the next couple of weeks to take part in the United Nations Climate Conference. We want to hear all about this and learn about this most important climate summit. But before we begin, I'd like to set the stage for this conversation today by reading a quote. This is from a group of people, and they're calling themselves Run for Your Life. It's a group of 1,000 runners and 1,000 reasons who are relay running 4,500 kilometers from the Arctic to Paris. This quote is from their first runner. Her name is Jenny Leite from Kiruna, which is the northernmost town in Sweden. Situated in the northern province of Lapland, she is a native Sami. And here is her quote. There is no change without protest. The only way to change is to resist, protect, react, mobilize, and challenge. I am fighting for a better future and earth justice. I am fighting for my children and generations to come. I am fighting for our mother, Mother Earth. She has the right to exist and to live. And with that, Gary, you're from Sandpoint, and you are an active Idaho Conservation League member and have been an active full-time environmental advocate for over 17 years. You are deeply concerned about the onrush of climate change and believe in the concept of think globally, act locally. I'm just reading from your bio. You are engaged in Bonner County and the region on issues of coal trains, coal export terminals, crude oil trains, active volunteer with the Idaho Conservation League, supporter of Lake Ponderay Waterkeeper and Friends of Scotchman Peak. You are also a husband, a father, and a grandfather. And you're traveling to Paris as a part of a delegation from the Presbyterian Church. So, Gary, as you prepare for your travels and then bear witness in Paris during the most important time of our climate, during the United Nations Climate Conference, you're here today to share this information with us. You're obviously very committed to this purpose. And what is the purpose of the conference?
Well, Susie, the purpose of the conference is very straightforward. It's to be able to develop an international agreement that puts the brakes on climate pollution and also to accelerate global movement toward a low-carbon economy. The conference of the parties, convenes 2 weeks from today. So it's fitting that we, on this Monday morning, acknowledge that 14 days from now, this major two-week global event will begin in Paris. The flow is very straightforward. On Monday, the 30th of November, heads of state from around the world, maybe as many as 80 or more presidents, prime ministers, will be present there for the opening of the Conference of the Parties. It'll be followed on that first week by continued negotiations for draft agreements that have been in work for many, many months by climate negotiators from the respective countries. And then in the second week, it will really ratchet itself up with ministers of respective countries coming to bring closure to the agreement so that hopefully by December 11th or December 12th, there will be a final agreement that will have multiple parts to it that will contribute to the reduction of carbon emissions in the world and have a pathway toward more sustainable development and sustainable energy for the next decades to come.
There must be a master goal. You may have said it. It's to reduce carbon emissions. And can you explain that a little bit more, what that really entails?
Sure. In a previous version of this conference, the one held in Copenhagen in 2009, one of the only things that the nations of the world could agree upon was that the world community needed to keep the average global temperature from increasing beyond 2 degrees centigrade. which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, based upon measurements from pre-industrial levels, and to be able to move toward the steps toward low-carbon economies. This issue of keeping global average temperature below 2 degrees is really at the heart of the agreement that is being discussed and hopefully will come to fruition in Paris. In order to be able to move toward that, the nations of the world have each brought forward their climate action plans. Over 150 of them have been brought forward. As they have been tallied up, it bends the curve in terms of the increase of the global average temperature, but the commitments that have been made to date do not yet bend that curve below what we can anticipate with a 2-degree increase. So a piece of the outcome that we hope for will be that there will be a regular reconvening of this group, that the agreement will include opportunities to come together at, say, every 5 years to review that which has been done by the nations, to ratchet up their commitments. All of these things flow forward in time. It's a concerted effort on the part of nations, governments, and businesses to be able to deal with carbon emissions, even while the space is created for greater investment in solar and wind, aspects of hydropower, the non-carbon polluting components of energy production.
When you talk about 2 degrees centigrade, let's just get back to that for a moment. It doesn't sound like, well, what's wrong with 5 degrees? What's the difference, pre-industrial increase in global temperature? Can you explain that a little bit? Because that seems like the demarcation point that they're working towards.
Well, it is a demarcation point because when we make this comparison from pre-industrial levels, the average global temperature across these decades has risen by 0.85 degrees centigrade, a degree and a half Fahrenheit. And this small increase that we've seen across these decades has already produced the permanent Arctic ice sheet, half of it melting away, millions of acres of trees that we have here in the Rocky Mountains and in Canada as well have died due to the warming conditions facilitated, opportunities for bark beetle, etc. We've already seen the beginning of increases of acidification of the oceans, the West Arctic glaciers beginning to disintegrate, prompting additional sea level rise. All of these things that I just mentioned here have taken place with an increase of 0.85. So the 2-degree goal has been set because it is generally agreed that significant increases beyond that will make portions of our planet uninhabitable, have huge impacts upon the human beings that live there, on the wildlife and all that and the created order that lives there. So we're talking about the potential of places on our planet becoming uninhabitable across the remainder of this century into the next century. So the agreement for 2 degrees is an important goal. It provides a marker that nation states can agree upon and the world community can work toward.
So when you say we're currently at 0.85, and we've already seen all that you mentioned as far as changes in our climate, the 2% or the 2 degrees increase, that seems, what would we expect at even 1.5?
Well, you can acknowledge that which we've already noted in our world today. As we take a look at around as we think about these things globally, it's important for us to be able to put this in a perspective here in North Idaho, Eastern Washington, and Western Montana. We've just come through one of the most horrific summers associated with wildfire. The wildfire that we've had are a function of drought. It's a function of low snowpack from the previous years. All of these are contributing factors from climate change that have begun to affect us directly. It goes beyond the issue, however, of just the fire season that we've just come through. We've seen the impact of reduced stream and river flow that has an impact upon such things as salmon movement. There was a conference just a couple weeks ago in Coeur d'Alene from regional climate scientists, and they were pointing out the immediate impacts that we've seen from climate change and the projection that we can fully anticipate that these conditions will worsen over the course of the next several years. All of that brings us back to the requirement for the nations of the world to come together in an agreement that is regularly reviewed, that can continue to pull humanity together toward combating further increases in average global temperature.
So a lot is really on the table here at this conference that's coming up in Paris, and you have felt strong pull to be part of that. You lined out a little bit of what to expect, but in conversation with you prior to this, you had a little bit more information. What will you be doing while you're there in Paris at this climate summit?
Let me answer that question in two parts. The first part is the personal why. I'll be traveling as a part of a small delegation from the Presbyterian Church USA, an historic mainline Protestant denomination in the United States, to gather with people in the faith community from around the world, whether they be other Christians, whether they be Buddhists, Muslim, Jewish, Baha'i, who are there in order to be able to encourage the formal delegates in the proceedings. One of the things that the faith community brings to this conversation is not just an awareness of the science, but an understanding of the criticality of the impact upon creation, upon humankind, and upon all that inhabit this. If you will, you can put that in terms of eco-justice. For those of us who live in North America, in this part of North America, we live a relatively sheltered, relatively privileged life. And the fact is that the most immediate impacts of the changing climate are borne by persons who had the least to do with increasing the carbon load in the atmosphere. They are the ones who are on the front lines in terms of immediate suffering, whether it be rural communities and farmers in southern Africa who have had their farming habits and their ability to feed their families disrupted, whether it is Pacific Islanders who are even this day struggling with the issue of rising sea levels threatening the small atolls where they live, whether it be places, as an example, from the major typhoon hurricane and typhoon in the Philippines just a couple years ago. These are people who live on the margins of society. So many in the faith community believe that we have the responsibility to both care for the earth, to care for God's creation, but also to care for the least of these. So these things are wrapped together. The second part of my answer has to do with the specifics in terms of what I hope to be able to do. I'm not a negotiator, but I will have the opportunity to observe the negotiations. I potentially will have the opportunity to be able to have conversation and share these current concerns, both from a North Idaho perspective, as well as from a broader faith perspective, with those who are actually at the table. And I hope to be able to bring back personal experiences, to have conversations with people in South Asia, to have conversations with people from Africa, to have conversations with people from the Pacific Islands, and to tell that story. So in a way, this is about bearing witness. It's about bearing witness to that which is going on and being in a position to share the story in written reflections, in blogs, in opportunities to debrief the experience that we've had. Some of it will be directed toward additional engagement with our congressional delegation. But more importantly, it's about expanding our awareness here in this part of the Northwest Rockies about the impact of the issues of climate change and what we can do about it here locally and how we need to be engaged.
Jean, did you have a question?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No.
As I said a few minutes ago, there's a lot on the table here in Paris at this conference, probably a big part of our future. And when you think about it, leadership, we talked about this before when we were just in conversation. There's been a lot of positive leadership recently. 2 weeks ago, President Obama rejected the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. putting the United States in a leadership position going into this conference. And as he said, America is now a global leader when it comes to taking serious action to fight climate change. So 180 countries, this agreement is going to be worked on for 2 weeks. Negotiations, who's facilitating this? And it's going to be quite a feat to bring that agreement about. As you said, in Copenhagen, it didn't quite happen the way they hoped. But we're at a different point in time right now. That was, what, 5 years ago? And now we stand here knowing a lot more where leadership, and as you said before, the momentum has changed. So who's facilitating this? How do you get 80 to 180 countries to agree?
Well, this has been a process that's been ongoing on a regular basis with regular involvements in the negotiators. On the one hand, we have President Hollande of France, who will take an active role as the host for the United Nations Climate Summit. And from a week-in and week-out basis across the year, the UN process has been headed by a diplomat named Cristiana Figueres. She is a Costa Rican expert on negotiations and climate activity, and her gentle way has been able to move and prod and bring many of the nation states with different views to the table so that progress might happen. We talk about momentum. Indeed, the United States has momentum going into this upcoming conference because of the actions that our nation has taken under President Obama over the course of the last couple of years. A part of that momentum began to roll out with the president issuing in June of 2013, a little over 2 years ago, our climate action plan. The climate action plan of this administration was a very broad strategic vision of reducing U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, of expanding what could be done in terms of renewable energy, of increasing the energy efficiency of cars and trucks and a variety of other appliances, of strengthening the resiliency that cities and states have to climate impact, and a final component of increasing the role of the United States in international involvement for activities that are going into Paris. So the individual actions that we've seen flow as a part of this plan. A piece of it was the president rejecting the expansion of the Keystone XL pipeline. A piece of it also has to do with the carbon action plans that began to be discussed in the August of this year, putting great responsibility on individual states to develop their approaches that can collectively let the United States continue to rely more upon renewable energy and reduce our dependence upon fossil fuels. But we're just one player on the world stage. In the run-up to Paris, a host of other critical, important voices have weighed in. I think a major turning point across those of us who were involved in the climate movement was Pope Francis' encyclical, a teaching letter released in June of this year. The encyclical focused on issues of climate change, our care for our common home, and an intense focus upon the least of these, the poor who are most affected from the impact of the major industrial powers, those least positioned to be able to do anything about it. So the Pope's visit to the United States, his conversation both at the White House, before Congress, before the United Nations, underscored in part those issues of our responsibilities toward creation, toward the climate. Other pieces of this momentum have been a major agreement between the United States and China, that China would move into a new role of its own reduction of its dependence upon fossil fuels, particularly coal, increasing significantly its reliance upon solar energy and solar power. And our neighbor to the north, just within the last few weeks, the election of Prime Minister Trudeau shifted significantly the political outlook from Canada in terms of how they were going to engage in Paris. And so all of these things flow together. They build a degree of momentum. behind this nation-state momentum are the millions and millions of people around the world who are involved and coming to the table. I'll be a part of what in UN speak is called civil society. There, of course, is the formal negotiations. But the civil society component will bring together like-minded persons concerned about the care of the earth, issues of the climate, from all over the world. They will assemble there and we'll have the opportunity for conversations, educational components, worship services, all of which add accent to the fact that there are tens of millions of human beings around the world that care deeply about these issues, to the point of some of them electing to travel in order to be able to be on the edges of these negotiations in Paris.
When you say the civil society and you're talking about the millions and millions of people, that's why we're having this conversation today, the importance of what is coming down in Paris, but also to educate and inform ourselves so that we know where we're going, such as the 1,000 runners of Run for Your Life. Obviously, they took up the challenge. And I just want to remind our listeners, this is 88.5 KRFY. We are here in the studios live with Gary Payton, who will be attending the Paris Climate Summit that's coming up in a couple weeks. It starts on November 30th and goes through December 11th. We also have Jean Girth. We'll get to have you talk here in just a few minutes.
Sure.
But Gary, I want to get back a little bit to momentum again. You've been involved in the environmental movement for 17 years, is what I read, and I just want to get your perspective of what you've seen in the changing attitudes and, as you say, momentum and understanding and involvement of people around you and in the world.
I think we're in a significantly different place today than we were 5 or 6 years ago. For those of us here in North Idaho who were choking on smoke in major portions of August, I think it was a wake-up call. I think for people who were either skeptical about issues of climate change or, in fact, may have been denying the reality of climate change, it was a moment to realize that, indeed, our climate is changing and it is affecting us daily and we have responsibilities. So when we have that wake-up call, we have the opportunities to look around us and see what we can do locally. Indeed, I've talked about this global awareness. We have a host of possibilities and concerns that we are dealing with here on a local and a regional basis. It is the unique nature of Sandpoint, as we well know, that all of the coal that is burned in a portion of the western United States or shipped to Canada for export to East Asia moves through Sandpoint on BNSF trains on the Montana Rail Link line coming from the Powder River Basin in southern Montana and in northeastern Wyoming. We are the focal point for that. We all know that we're at the top of that rail funnel that moves from Sandpoint to Spokane and then moves out across the web. Beyond that, there's the other components in terms of our role as a transit site for other aspects of fossil fuel. There's been a 44-time increase in the number of oil trains that move out of North Dakota across the last 6 or 7 years. Hundreds of those now transiting Sandpoint, Idaho, on BNSF lines to be able to move to terminals and refineries on the West Coast. And there are facility plans underway for the expansion of that. So all of these bring opportunities for us to be engaged here locally in these broader issues.
I know that recently Portland, the city of Portland, which is close to home, passed a groundbreaking policy to stop new fossil fuel infrastructure being built. And I take it that to mean oil and coal shipping depots. So that's a positive, one little ray of sunshine there in that whole thought about coal trains. And I also want to kind of stopping the fossil fuel. there was, I'm looking for my piece of paper. That's how it goes on the radio. When President Obama rejected the Keystone XL pipeline, he also said, we're going to have to keep some fossil fuels in the ground rather than burn them and release more dangerous pollution into the sky. The logic is clear. If we don't extract them, we can't burn them. Even better, this is a change the president can actually make without the approval of Congress. Within the climate summit meeting in Paris, with the climate summit meeting in Paris near, the Keystone decision helps the United States, again, as I said before, take a leadership role. But keeping it in the ground is another thing that people are working towards. And if there are not depots to export it, then what happens? There's no reason to take it out of the ground. So let's go into that a little bit about these depots on the West Coast that are still in the development stages or the approval stages. Can you tell us a little bit about that? I know that there's a hearing coming up for the Tesoro Savage Oil Terminal in Vancouver. Vancouver.
And I think the ICL website can keep people up to date on those kind of events, too. Idaho Conservation League, the website. I don't have off of the top of my head, but it's been a real leader in activating people in this region.
So our concerns about oil and coal trains coming through Sandpoint could shift and change if there's no place for all those trains to get rid of their stuff.
Yeah, although I think that it probably may work the other way around, is in addressing the corporate push to have those fossil fuels extracted. They're not going to stop just because there's not a depot, but it's a great public, it's something that the public can do, and they do have public hearings on it. So it's some place where you can show up and say, no, this is not what we want.
So when we talk about these, we can divide them into issues of coal and issues of oil. On the coal side, several years ago, there were as many as 6 different coal export terminals being proposed in Oregon and Washington. Over the course of the years, those have been winnowed down to 2. The 2 active proposals are for a coal export terminal at Cherry Point near Bellevue, Washington, and in Longview, Washington, on the Columbia River. These are intended to be able to facilitate the shipment of coal from the Powder River Basin, which will all roll through Sandpoint, to countries in East Asia for them to burn in coal-fired power plants, contributing additional CO2 into the air. These are long and involve permitting processes. We are anticipating the draft environmental impact statement for the Longview terminal to come out in early 2016. When that draft environmental impact statement comes out, it gives us as citizens the opportunity to offer comment upon that draft environmental impact statement. And likely there will be a hearing in Spokane, as there was in a previous part of this process, for persons to attend, lift up their concerns, both for their family, their region, and for the world. The Longview terminal will be focused on coal export. Currently today, the only export terminals for coal are in Canada, in the greater Vancouver area. There are no coal export terminals on the west coast of the United States. So there is significant business pressure, fossil fuel company, to be able to have these terminals built so that the product can be exported. And it's a part of this broader question of if the business plans of all of the fossil fuel companies and the reserves of all of the fossil fuel companies in the world were fully exploited, it would constitute breaking through the limits by 5 times what the atmosphere can absorb. So the number comes down to, alluded to in President Obama's statement, that as much as 80% of the known fossil fuel reserves of the day need to not be exploited, not be mined, not be drilled, not be put out for production and burn, if we are to maintain any hope of staying within the habitable limits of the increase in global average temperature and the impacts. When we shift specifically to the oil train issue, we here in Sandpoint are keenly aware of the movement of unit trains from the Bakken oil fields, or from the occasional movement of trains carried on the Union Pacific line with Canadian Pacific engines that move tar sands from Alberta toward western West Coast refineries. Today we're dealing with in the range of 10 to 20 unit crude oil trains moving through Sandpoint on a weekly basis. The range is about 10 to 18 moving on the BNSF line, and about 2 per week moving on the Montana Rail Link line that all moves its way forward. The most immediate issue on the table with respect to the many refinery and terminal facilities being looked at in Washington is the one that you mentioned, Susie, Vancouver, Washington, the Tesoro Savage proposed oil terminal, one of the largest ever proposed in the United States. We are anticipating that the draft environmental impact statement for that terminal will be released on the 24th of November, just a few weeks from now, and that that will begin a 45-day comment period for citizens to be able to express their concerns, if that's where they are, to the authorities in Washington State. More importantly, there will be a hearing in Spokane regarding the Tesoro Savage Vancouver oil terminal. Environmental and conservation organizations here in Sandpoint will try to rally people and provide transportation so that their voices can be heard at that hearing in Spokane. That leadership will be shared by the Idaho Conservation League, will be shared by the Lake Pendere Waterkeeper in order to be able to create the circumstance for people to go down and be involved in that, in those hearings. I'm anticipating that when that draft environmental impact statement comes out around the 24th of November, that we will have press releases about it, both in the Bonner County Bee as well as the Spokesman Review, to accent the opportunity for citizens to comment.
How much of the citizens, you talk about folks going down to Spokane, and that Idaho Conservation League and Lake Pendere Waterkeeper will help get people there so they can testify and share their feelings about the proposed Tesoro depot. How much impact on the outcome, the decision to build these terminals, does the citizens' voice have? Gene?
Well, I'm smiling just because of my involvement in other issues, and I've been to a lot of public meetings, and I know sometimes it feels futile to stand up and say your piece or write your letter. You don't know where it goes to, but it does make a difference, and I'm specifically thinking of the Rock Creek Mine that has been fought successfully for the last 25 years. To me, another big part of this is that it is an opportunity for people to get together and stand up and be seen. And whether it's by a letter or a public comment or just gathering with other people so that you can get to know your community and get to know who else is involved in doing this so that we're all better informed, we need to be standing up and doing it. It is an opportunity for it. All of these are opportunities, and we should take advantage of them. And I'm thinking of the kayak demonstrations in Portland on the eve of the Arctic drilling being, which was approved, and then the oil companies went, it's too hard. We're not going to get what we want out of there. But it might not have been the cause of that. It might not have, the kayak demonstrators might not have prevented that, but it sure brought a lot of nice publicity to what that whole event was about. And in retrospect, I think you can look back and go, yeah, wow, they did something. And people need to feel like they can do something on some level, because it is an overwhelming proposition.
Without any action, that nothing will happen.
Yeah, and the and we've got, you know, it's wonderful that this UN climate summit is taking place, and I just wanted to add to Gary's wealth of information about it some of my perspective from coming in a little bit more recently, and I went back and read some of the history of the climate summits. You know, it started in 1992. And if they hadn't started in 1992, we wouldn't be where we are today. So it's not solved anything in this time period, but it's led to something that might make a big difference. The United States, or the United Nations, it's formally called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And it's a treaty. It's an international legal treaty, and the UN is really the only venue for that, because of the number of, it's virtually universal, and it is someplace where the smaller players can get heard. One of the things I was thinking about when Gary, when you're talking about these immediate impacts that we see, is one of the more documentable ones is the sea level rise, and what's that's going to do to population centers, and how it's going to impact people, and where they're going to, you know, how are we going to deal with that? Are they going to move? Are they going to try to keep the sea at bay? New York City is certainly facing this, and I think if you talk to any politician in New York City, they're not going to deny that climate change has had a big impact there. So we need to stay abreast of that, because sometimes I think things like forest fires, people can go, oh, well, we've had other bad fire seasons. And we have had other bad fire seasons. But the overwhelming evidence now, and I'm heartened, because in the last, I would say even 1 to 2 years, is when you turn on the news now, people don't apologize for saying climate change. They say, they'll be reporting a news event and they'll go, because of climate change. And so I think people really have accepted it. And if you need any convincing, it's not the scientists who are not, you know, they're convinced. People who talk about climate change not being real are not quoting science. And
so
there's a lot of evidence.
It feels like there's been a turning point.
I
can say that too.
I feel that way. It's there's still some deniers at the top levels, like in our Senate. But I don't think there's really any controversy anymore.
And once a majority of people become informed, that's why we're having this conversation today, you have information that can lead you somewhere. And to deciding different things. I heard a quote recently, you know, in years past, well, some people will show up that will help fix this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I read this thing that said, we are the ones we've been waiting for. Now is the time. And Gary, your impetus and feelings, positive feelings of going to Paris are part of that. You know, you made a decision. You want to be part of a global movement right at the source. And we're very happy that you will be kind of there as a delegate from Sandpoint, so to speak, because you love our area too and our whole world. And when we think about that, there's a lot going on locally.
Yes, there is.
So let's talk about some of those things, Jean. Jean Girth, just to introduce you, you've been here in this area for a long time. You've been involved with Rock Creek Alliance since its beginning. You're also involved in several other environmental groups. And tell us why you're involved and what you kind of initiated here recently, and what Sandpoint citizens can participate, how they can participate.
Yeah, and my motivation, I think, is from seeing leadership moving in the right direction, but really gut feeling is that it has to come from both sides. It has to come from leadership, and it has to come from the grassroots and from the bottom up. And so when I started, well, last year there was a meeting in, where was that? In Copenhagen? Was that last? The Leaders Climate Summit. They had a meeting in anticipation of this one this year. And there were marches, and there was, in New York City, there were 400,000 people who came out. And in worldwide, there were hundreds of thousands of people came out basically saying, yes, we need to do something about climate change. So I didn't want to go to, I didn't want to drive to Spokane last year, so I didn't go. And when this meeting, when I started thinking, oh yeah, this is coming up in December, this next climate summit, it's like, I don't want to drive to Spokane to do that either. So what are we going to do? Well, we're going to have one in Sandpoint.
So tell us about that and the organization that has formed to kind of hold the intention here.
Yeah. And I guess first I want to say, though, too, is to acknowledge what's already going on in town, which Gary's already spoken to. But anything that I talk about is just trying to maybe have a little bit different focus, because a lot of the on-the-ground work is spearheaded by Idaho Conservation League and Lake Pend'Oreille Waterkeepers. And there's another organization in town in national scope that's also addressing climate adaptation plans, and that's Model Forest Policy Program. But my little piece to all of this was, I get mad and I want to go out and march. So I started Googling around. Well, I don't want to, you know, start from the ground up on this. And there's this wonderful organization called 350.org that I read about, and they promote local chapters and support local chapters to specifically build momentum with a global grassroots movement that, and I'm quoting from them, mm-hmm. that can hold our leaders accountable to the realities of science and the principles of justice.
And real quick, what does 350 stand for?
It's 350 parts per million was projected as the highest amount of carbon that we can have in the environment and still have a sustainable world the way we know it. And I think we're above 400 now. And actually, my real introduction was when Idaho Conservation League, Susan, organized a thing, and we all went down to City Beach and held up our little cards, and we were standing in a formation that said 350 on it.
I saw that picture.
It's now, she told me it's down at the Capitol building in Boise. So again, you know, a lot of this stuff has been going on for a long time. But I read about 350.org, quickly was pointed in Gary's direction, who is pretty familiar with that organization, and we formed a small committee. We are now a local Sandpoint chapter. We have a website that's in formation at 350sandpoint.org, and we are going to have a march on Sunday, November 29th, starting at 1 p.m. It's still a little bit, I don't have all of the plans stamped with approval, but I think we're going to start in City Beach. I still need to talk to the Parks Department about that. But gather at the Pavilion at 1 o'clock on Sunday and then march to the Little Panada Theater, where we're going to have a good time. And mm-hmm. we are going to remember that this needs to be done in an atmosphere of love and not fear. And I do want to promote people just networking. I just want to be a tent where people can gather and get to know their neighbors, get to know what's going on in town, get to know what they can do, and be educated. So hopefully we're going to have music there.
When you talk about networking, 350sandpoint.org also has a Facebook site. You
yes.
can go there and like that organization, and then you will get updates and postings. And that's how it's working right now.
It is
networking.
And I'm old and I'm Facebook phobic. So
no,
thank
it's
you,
working.
Susie.
It's working.
Susie does Facebook. And, you know, we need more people. If anybody out there is interested in helping organize this, I actually have I have another email address that's sandpoint350@gmail.com. It's the flip. The mm-hmm. website's 350 Sandpoint. Right now, the email address is sandpoint350@gmail.com. But if you'd like more information, either email or get on the Facebook, join the group, which is 350 Sandpoint on Facebook. And I don't know. That's my motivation. Gary has something.
The opportunity then on the 29th of November here in Sandpoint then corresponds with similar activity, similar marches around the world. Even in the aftermath of the horrific acts on Friday night in Paris, there still will be tens of thousands of people on Sunday the 29th, the day before the UN conference begins in Paris, marching in the city of Paris, just as 400,000 people came out in New York City in fall of last year.
And it will be, I'm sure it's going to be global. I'm sure there's going to be marches in all over the world.
You can actually go to 350.org and look at where the marches are. There's one in Spokane. There's one in Nelson, B.C., mm-hmm. Missoula. Those are more local. I think Sandpoints will be on that site.
We are now on the map. Mm-hmm. We are on the 350.org
so
map.
So really it's joining together.
So as another opportunity for those of us here in the local area, Idaho Conservation League is planning an event at noon on the 8th of December, and that event will be held in the conference room at the Columbia Bank upstairs above the waterfall and the atrium. And if all goes well, and if we can make the technology work the way we want it to, I hope to be able to Skype in from Paris to be a part of that gathering from 12 to 1 or so on Tuesday the 8th.
Kind of give us a little update, right, direct
sure,
from
absolutely.
Paris.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's the hope.
Mm-hmm.
It's the
That'll
hope
be
to
fun.
Be able to have to share some images and to share some live reporting in terms of what the mood is all about and how things have gone to that point. Additionally, at that gathering on the 8th here in Sandpoint, the energy associate for the Idaho Conservation League, Ben Otto, will come back to Sandpoint and be able to share a little bit of information in that gathering about the Clean Power Plan, the Idaho Clean Power Plan. The Idaho Clean Power Plan is our state's piece of the overall carbon plan for the nation that has been proposed because these plans are being broken out by city and by state. This is a chance for citizens here locally to hear about how we can, how our state is moving forward.
And those plans have been, they're mandated at this point, aren't they, fed under the Clean Air Act?
It's a part of making all of this actionable, and each state is developing its own. So Ben will give us some updates in terms of our involvement, how things are progressing, how we can encourage Governor Otter to move forward to expand our use of renewables and reduce our use on fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm. And then hopefully on December 12th, 350.org, they call this building momentum, and it certainly is. There's going to be more global marches on December 12th, which marks the end of the climate summit, and to bring the point home that we are still interested in paying attention. We don't have anything planned yet for that in Sandpoint, but I'm hoping to get to that point too.
You can stay tuned. Go
yes.
to 350 Sandpoint on Facebook, and there will be postings of all events. So there's many ways locally that we can be in community with this event. There's the march with 350sandpoint.org on November 29th. They'll meet at City Beach at 1 p.m., and then have a little gathering at the Panada Little Panada after
mm-hmm.
that. And on December 8th at noon in the upstairs conference room of the Columbia Bank building, there'll be an Idaho Conservation League event where Gary will be Skyping directly from Paris. I'm sure it will work, Gary. And also Ben Otto from the Idaho Conservation League will be updating us on the Idaho Clean Power Plan. And then again on December 12th, stay tuned. There may be more events from 350sandpoint.org.
Can I just add,
sure.
I'd also like to encourage people to go to the 350.org site and read their, they call it a manifesto. It really speaks to their values. And if you mm-hmm. can agree with the 10 points that are in there, I think you've found a group that you can work with.
It can be life-changing to read things like that.
I think there are going to be many ways for citizens to be able to follow what's going on in Paris. Clearly, there will be news coverage. There will both lots of coverage across the internet as well as regular things in our newspapers and social media. One of the reasons that I'm going is to be able to offer reflections upon what it feels like, what the circumstances like, the persons with whom I'm interacting. I have no high expectations of influencing any of the specific national negotiators, but I hope to be able to share the message for those of us here locally with what it feels like, what it's all about, what the mood is all about. On the one hand, the blog posts that I will be sending from Paris will be available on the Idaho Conservation League website.
Mm-hmm.
From a faith perspective, they will be available on the Presbyterian Church USA Environmental Ministries Eco Journey blog, and they will talk about interactions of many in the faith community that are present there, be it the World Council of Churches, Action Alliance, Orthodox churches from around the world, others in other faith traditions. So I'll be blogging two or three times a week, and those will be posted on a variety of websites, both environmental, non-governmental organizations, as well as across the Presbyterian Church national website.
Lots of ways to stay connected. And we certainly wish you well, Gary, on your journey. And thank you for bringing a bit of North Idaho's presence to this historic, from what I'm gathering, climate summit. So please come back from the conference and come back to KRFY at 88.5 for a follow-up interview and tell us all about it and this amazing agreement that's going to come out of it that's going to make an impact on the direction that the world goes. I like the thought of 350sandpoint.org being part of a global movement.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Gene, thanks for helping initiate that off the ground as we move forward. And anything else you want to say, Gene?
No, I'd just like to see all of your faces. And if anybody has something they'd like to contribute, please email or get onto the Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. And Gary, yes, I'd like to definitely give us a little wrap up and then we'll sign off here.
I and millions of people are approaching this conference in Paris with a spirit of hope. If it flows like they typically flow, we'll have press reportings about how difficult it is, the challenges that the negotiators are having, a degree of brinksmanship right up to the end of the second week. There are important questions that are out there. What will be the balance between issues of mitigation, that's the efforts to reduce climate emissions, and adaptation, the work that the nations are going to be involved in? There are going to be important questions about finances. How much will the developing nations ante up in order to be able to assist the developing world in compensating for the changes from the climate? What will be the political will that national leaders return to their capitals with or without to be able to follow through? But I'm going into this, as are millions of others, with a sense of hope that this action can be one of many steps required of us in the future in order to be able to deal with this greatest challenge to humankind. It's important for us here locally. It's important for the least of these around the world. It's important for our children and our grandchildren and all the critters that we enjoy interacting with in this creation.
Well, well said. And thank you very much for coming in. Again, we wish you well on your journeys, and we will be with you. And thanks for sharing your passion on this subject. Also, I would be remiss in not mentioning that on this Monday morning, just 3 days after the ruthless attacks on the civilians in Paris, France, we join with the world in prayer and heartfelt support for our French brothers and sisters and to all people and countries around the world who are victims of aggression and terror. Also, I want to remind you, this is 88.5 KRFY. And tomorrow morning, please tune in to the Tuesday edition of the KRFY Morning Show with Chris and Susie. Our guests will be Sandy Compton, Program Director of Friends from Scotchman Peaks Wilderness. That's at 8 a.m. on 88.5 KRFY. And anything else? Just thank you so much, both Gary and Gene, Gary Payton and Gene Girth, for coming in today.
Thanks, Susie.
It was a nice conversation and hopeful.
Yes.
This is Otis Redding. We're going to leave you with Otis Redding. After that, we'll have Bird Notes, and the rest of the day is Otto's Eclectic Mix. So we hope you have a beautiful day. And this is Otis Redding, I Can't Get No Satisfaction.